Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Robert Johnson, and I'm here with my obnoxious imaginary friend, Chris Webb.
Hello.
Hello, Chris. Hey, snotface.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm pretty good. It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
See you, nice.
Nice to see you. So how have you been, Chris?
A little bit tired, usual stuff, sick children. But yeah. It's still officially summer out there, so it's been another lovely day, walking the dog, walking the children.
Any imaginary friends for the kids?
Yes, actually. My youngest daughter, I think she's grown out of him now, but she, for about the last year, has had an imaginary friend called Carrot.
Carrot? Jasper Carrot?
I wish.
Yeah, well, it couldn't have been him because there's only one Jasper Carrot.
She'd have been going around on his funky moped. But no, everything that we talk about, it's, oh yeah, Carrot's done that, Carrot's done this. Carrot's dead now. I saw Carrot yesterday.
Carrot's dead.
That's... Yeah, Carrot was dead, so yeah, I said, yeah, I ate him. But then Carrot came. Carrot lives in Wellington. So you might have met him.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll have to try and catch up with him for a coffee.
I think he'd quite like that. What about you? Any imaginary friends down your way?
For a period of time in my childhood, I believed in God. But that was...
He is the best imaginary friend.
Yeah. Never really had imaginary friends.
It sounds quite ironic, but I thought it was something that people made up, that they actually had them. You know what I mean?
It sounds like a joke, though, doesn't it?
You know what I mean, though, don't you?
I do, yeah. It's like one of those things. It's like the way people talk about dreams or something. I'm always like, I never dream like that. And why are we harping on about imaginary friends, you might ask? Well, you wouldn't ask, Chris.
So, Rob, why are we harping on about imaginary friends?
Well, because, Chris, you chose a film about an imaginary friend.
I did choose a film about an imaginary friend. There are probably two great films that involve imaginary friends.
Yeah.
One, of course, is Inside Out by Pixar, which we didn't choose.
Yes.
The other one is 1991's Drop Dead Fred.
Now Lizzie is all grown up.
To us.
And when her perfect life fell apart.
Charles, I lost my money, my car, my husband.
She didn't get mad.
Drop Dead Fred.
She got Fred.
Where's the face?
What, who dropped dead? Drop Dead Fred is this imaginary friend that I had as a child, and he's back.
Everybody has strange friends, even you must.
But all mine are alive.
Well, that's not saying much.
It's no wonder Charles left you.
Haven't got a husband, got a stupid haircut.
You see, you just don't know how to make a marriage work.
Well, let's get Charles back then. I'll help you.
Let's just behave ourselves. Get up.
No, bandit.
He's back.
Yeah, well, what's wrong with that?
Wow, Drop Dead Fred. You, of course, left out A Beautiful Mind.
Oh, yeah. That's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it, for A Beautiful Mind?
When I was watching Drop Dead Fred, I was thinking, imagine if you replaced the imaginary friend and other imaginary friend movies with Fred, and how that would... I think it was a coping mechanism as I was getting through the film. And I was thinking, you know, imagine if Russell Crowe was talking to Rick Mayall in A Beautiful Mind.
His roommate is Rick Mayall, smashing his head against the pane of glass. And that's sort of...
Yeah, or Tyler Durden was Rick Mayall.
That would be brilliant, actually.
That would be brilliant. Fight Club with Rick Mayall would have been...
Imagine the fights. There'd be frying pans.
Aidan Vincent's pro would have been better.
Yeah. They could have done a version of Fight Club. That would have been brilliant.
And I always liked that film Cloak and Dagger with Henry Thomas and Dabney Coleman. Not sure if you ever saw that.
I don't think I've had the pleasure, no.
I think the imaginary friend was called Jack Flash, and he was a spy. But he was Dabney Coleman, who was also the character's dad. And that was really cool. I really liked that film when I was a kid.
I suppose imaginary friends or imaginary people in films have become quite the norm as a twist over the last couple of years. I mean,
they have.
Things like Secret Window, that Johnny Depp one where...
Yeah.
Oh, shock. It's him, really. And there's a really good French horror film called Haute Tension, or High Tension, where the major twist at the end is actually that. She thinks she's being pursued by a psycho serial killer. Turns out it's her all along.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Does sound rather haughtily tense.
Yeah. But I can't recommend people watch it now because I've just given it away.
Yeah, oh well. Spoiler alert. Yep. We'll just edit in a spoiler alert. And in another spoiler alert, Captain Howdy in The Exorcist is actually a demon, not an imaginary friend.
Yeah, and he's not the devil either.
No.
Captain Howdy, yeah.
He is, yeah. Wind Demon.
Which used to be my nickname at school. My actual friends called me.
So, Drop Dead Fred, 1991 film by a director who, if there was a dictionary definition of obscure directors, probably have a picture of this guy.
Yeah, because we want a knockabout comedy starring Britain's up-and-coming madman Rick Mayall. Who can we get to do it? Let's get a Dutch director who's made some arthouse horror films and a couple of episodes of Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Let's choose Atte de Jong.
Atte de Jong, going through the whole, even the writers as well. Mm. One of them, I think, has written a few successful novels. Carlos something or other.
Carlos Davis.
And the other one was a sort of champion, is he a swimmer or cyclist? Or
Your research is much better than mine. I've just written next to all the names, bugger all of note.
I should have written this down. Well, apparently Russell Mulcahy did a movie about the other screenwriter, because he was an Australian athlete.
Oh.
He just dabbled in Drop Dead Fred, and that was
amazing.
And as you watch the film, perhaps it becomes apparent that... When did you see this?
I saw this when I was a student. Came out in 1991, and it was the first major film to star Rick Mayall.
Yeah.
If you discount American Werewolf in London, obviously. I was just the right age for him to be my hero. I was 10 when Kevin Turvey first appeared in A Kick Up the 80s, which was a very bizarre sketch show. It sort of followed in the coattails of Not the 9 O'Clock News. It was on BBC Scotland, and the cast included including Robbie Coltrane, Tracy Ullman, Miriam Margolyes. And then there were strange sort of stand-up monologues from Richard Stilgo, the piano-playing satirist. And then slap bang in the middle for about 5 minutes, there'd be something called Kevin Turvey Investigates, which was Rick Mayall just doing a 5-minute rant in a chair.
Do you know how much it costs to go to America? 96 quid, that's how much. But am I going to get that kind of money? I'm not, that's where. So I'm never ever going to America. Ever. Anyway, good evening, my name's Kevin Turvey. And here's a good one. Why does Mrs. Thatcher always wear barbed wire underwear? She doesn't. It's a joke.
As a 10-year-old, I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. I didn't know he was called Rick Mayall. He was done in the cast as Kevin Turvey. So I didn't know he was Rick Mayall for about 4 years. He used to be with Ade Edmondson. They were called 20th Century Coyote. And he used to do a lot of characters for that. One was Kevin Turvey. One was Rick the People's Poet.
Yeah.
And together they did the Dangerous Brothers, which I'm sure you've seen, which is just utter violence. Yeah. It's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
So it all sort of stemmed from there. But it was a very strange fit putting him in with this kind of cozy sketch show. He wasn't in any of the sketches, just this little 5-minute monologue in the middle of it. And from there he did a spin-off called Kevin Turvey, The Man Behind the Green Door, which is about an hour-long comedy mockumentary, which is very funny. That's where he sings Downtown.
Yeah.
And from there, of course, he was doing Comic Strip in London with everybody, and Channel 4 bought that, so of course the Comic Strip Presents started round about the same time as The Young Ones. So I think I was about 11 when The Young Ones and the Comic Strip started, so I was the perfect age just for Rick Mayall to be my absolute idol. And he still is. He's my comedy idol.
We should mention that this is 2 or 3 days after his birthday?
Yeah, his birthday was Sunday. His birthday was on Thursday, yeah.
Yeah, you posted up a nice little tribute of...
I did, because I do miss him. It does break my heart that he's gone.
Yeah. It's not right. And by all accounts, he sort of sounded like quite a relatively scandal-free kind of life, wasn't
absolutely.
It, really?
One of the biggest scandals he had was a head injury on a quad bike, and the incident with Stephen Fry, where Stephen Fry buggered off to Belgium in the middle of Cellmates at the West End. Yeah. So he was kind of just by association, really.
But for a guy who's sort of had a persona of this kind of anarchic, grotty guy,
he was by all accounts very shy and down to earth. You see him on chat shows like Wogan or whatever, he was always a little bit shy and a little bit reserved. And friend of the show, Stuart Cowan, he was lucky enough to go and see Waiting for Godot that Rick and Aid did in London. And he hung round afterwards and chatted with them, and he just said Rick was lovely.
Did he say hey, you guys should do a sitcom that's kind of basically Beckett? But
well, it did say in the program he's got that they're about to appear in a sitcom called Bottom. So it was just that time.
I read that when they did Waiting for Godot was when they kind of got the idea for Bottom.
So it was just before Bottom was, I think they were starting to shoot Bottom, but he just said Rick Mayall was lovely. Even as he was walking away, you could hear like Rick shout in, "Oh, thanks for coming. Hope you enjoyed it," and all this sort of stuff.
Fantastic. It was really, really nice. That's nice. I first became a big fan of Rick Mayall when The New Statesman
came out.
Yes. So my first encounter was the Living Doll music video when I must have been about 5.
Oh, you must have loved that.
I knew of Cliff Richard, but I didn't know who these other kind of guys were. when The New Statesman came out, I think I was about 10, and my sister, my older sister, absolutely just thought it was the most hilarious thing, and she kind of would sit there filling me in on what it was all about and what was happening. And I just thought Alan Bastard was the greatest character. You know, I knew that he was awful, but he was just so kind of charismatic and appealing. And it was a real introduction to kind of adult themes for me, like this kind of, you know, bisexual promiscuous wife and the corruption. And yeah, I loved it. And my parents let me sort of stay up, I think, half an hour late on a Mondays to watch it. And it was just so good.
It was really great.
It was brilliant. And Lord Flashart and Captain Flashart, just thought, who is this guy? He's amazing. Should have his own show. And then, The Young Ones, I kind of, during reruns is when I sort of caught on to The Young Ones. And
we were hooked on The Young Ones. We recorded every episode. And my brother and I, we could recite the whole series. If my brother was sat here now, which of course he isn't because he lives in Sheffield, but if he was sat here now, we could just roll off the entire script to Series 1, Episode 6, Flood, because that was the one that we watched the most often. I'm afraid to go back and watch it. I haven't watched it for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm scared to, just in case. I'd imagine it's not aged that well. But it's one of the few things, The Young Ones in particular, that even though it was for the kids or people in school, my dad bloody loved it.
Even now,
if I talk to him on the phone, he will quote a line from The Young Ones. But like an obscure one. Like, oh, he really gets off on Barry and things like that, which if you haven't seen it, you don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
It's kind of strange that it's, Rick, because, you know, he wasn't a bad-looking bloke. And he could do the kind of leading man type thing.
He did a series for ITV called Rick Mayall Presents, where it was an hour-long sort of comedy drama every single time, a different story, different character. So it was him sort of working his acting chops. And in some of those, he's quite the matinee idol. There's one called, called Dancing Queen, where he's a man who's just woken up after his stag night and he's in bed with the stripper. And it turns out that he's in love with the stripper. He's not in love with his bride-to-be at all. So it's like a romantic comedy with him and Helena Bonham Carter.
Oh, wow.
And in that, he's a very handsome fellow. You should look them up. They're really good.
I'd have to.
That was Drop Dead Fred. So I saw it on... Didn't go to the movies to see it. I saw it on video when I was a student. And because he was in it doing his Rick Mayall shtick, I thought it was absolutely wonderful. Nothing else mattered in the whole film. It was just him running around, getting bashed in the bollocks, getting hit with a frying pan, throwing snot around and just being generally obnoxious. And it was great. So I thought, well, I still love him. Could it have aged? Could it? Shall we find out?
Yes, let's. So, of course, we've spent a lot of time talking about Rick Mayall, but the other, actually, the star, really, of this film, if not Rick Mayall, is Phoebe Cates,
Phoebe Cates, even though... You know, he is the title character.
He is the title character.
And he owns every scene that he's in. She is apparently the lead, the protagonist.
Yeah, she is the straight woman.
She's the Ernie Wise.
Yeah, to his zany, puerile antics. Phoebe Cates, of course, left an indelible impression on me as a child in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Indelible, you mean it didn't wash out?
Yeah, chucked it out. just chucked that t-shirt out.
For the best.
But my first encounter with Phoebe Cates was actually in a miniseries called Lace. I'm not sure if you ever saw this.
Which one of you bitches is my mother?
Yeah. One of the greatest lines in TV history, according to TV Guide.
Yeah, but then we got Lace 2, which is Which of You Bastards Is My Father? If you haven't seen Lace 2, it's remarkable.
I didn't like Lace 2 because they replaced Bess Armstrong's character with Deborah Raffin, who just wasn't... Just didn't cut it for me.
I thought that would have been the case.
Yeah. So Phoebe Cates, this was just a few years before her retirement, really. After this, she did Princess Caribou. Then that was her last major film before retiring.
Oh, so what's she up to now?
Don't know. Probably just having a really nice life with her husband, Kevin Kline, and their children. And
It must be quite nice to be married to Kevin Kline, because you always know what mood he's in, is whether he's got a moustache or not. If he's got a moustache, you know he's going to be full of fun.
Yeah.
And if he hasn't, he's going to be all sad and miserable.
Well, he should keep the moustache, really, because he doesn't have an upper lip.
Yeah, facial hair suits some people, doesn't it? Yeah.
Tom Selleck.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, so it's basically a two-hander, Rick Mayall and Phoebe Cates. And we kick off with a sort of a pre-credits sequence, don't we?
Yeah, it's a bedtime story where a little, she's probably about 6 years old, Elizabeth or Lizzie, who is, of course, the young Phoebe Cates, is being read a bedtime story by her mum. And I thought we were going to be off to a good start because she reads this story about princes and princesses and little Lizzie just says, what a pile of shit.
It's quite good, eh?
I thought we were going places.
Yeah. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And then straight into the credits, which are sort of like these animated kids kind of crayon drawing
quite fun.
Toys getting mangled and while this kind of zany funhouse carnival kind of music plays. And I thought we were off to a good start. Well, I mean, it was a cheap sort of shock joke and this cute little six-year-old girl say shit.
But straight after the credits, we're 21 years later and we see adult Lizzie, Phoebe Cates. Her life's in a bit of turmoil. She's married to Charles, played by Tim Matheson.
Yeah.
Who's wasted in this.
He does do a good job of being just an utter sleazebag, though.
He does it very well.
But he's totally wasted. It's a really one-note character.
And very much like you mentioned Tom Selleck, he was very nearly Indiana Jones.
Oh, wow.
He was about one of the last three, because on the special edition DVDs, there's screen tests of him reading, all in full costume and stuff. So he was quite close to being Indy.
Because he was in 1941, wasn't he?
Tom Wilson. Was, yeah. With all of the animals.
Spielberg link. Sporting a really bad 90s hair and a really bad 90s suit.
It's like a Farrow Fleck effect on it. It's very, very nice.
Yeah.
But it's clear that he's a philanderer. But Elizabeth being very insecure, she's trying to win him back, even though she's, well, allegedly she's not at fault, but it is like being married to somebody from the Brethren, by the way that she acts and dresses.
She's got that kind of ankle length sort of denim skirt thing.
I know it's unfair and quite misogynist when you discuss a female performance to immediately go to her clothing.
Yeah.
But she looks like an extra from Whitney.
She does.
So why would Charles have been interested in her in the first place?
Yeah, it doesn't work. I mean, she's gorgeous. Phoebe Cates is gorgeous.
Yes.
So maybe at one point, there was just that. But personality-wise, the two characters just don't...
Charles is clearly a man of the world.
Yeah.
And she isn't.
Yeah, and her character and characterization kind of brings us to one of the, I'd say, the critical problems of this film, which is it's kind of promoted as a kids film, or kind of a, you know, zany kids film. Drop Dead Fred was this character that kids were going to love. But the subject matter, there's a whole lot of dark stuff in here. You know, it's an emotionally abused young woman who's been kind of, you know, emotionally manipulated and abused by mum and her husband. She's divorcing. There's a whole lot of dark stuff here. She's been negged kind of by her husband and almost gaslighted, but not quite.
Yeah. So who would the target audience be? Would it be children who've had that kind of emotional manipulation throughout their entire life, like Macaulay Culkin or something?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think back to when I saw this on video when I was probably 10 or 11, and at the time that I watched it, I remember getting underwhelmed even as a sort of 10, 11-year-old. I was attracted to the special effects. This concept just didn't go where it could have for me. Yeah, and you watch it, and on the rewatch, it was like, wow, okay, there's a lot of adult themes going on here.
There's sexuality, mental illness. It's all going on.
Someone says wet dream. Harry Fisher's boyfriend who's married said that I never had imaginary friends, I had wet dreams.
And then there's some conversations about how basically he can maintain an erection for the entire night.
And a certain kind of kids film could be deft enough to slot that stuff in without really breaking the spell of it being a kids film.
But it would need to be a lot more subtle than
that. Have to be a lot more subtle. It would have to be very clever. It would have to be a very, very good, funny film that you could just slot that in without it being jarring. And I struggled when I was watching this going, who is this pitched at? Is this for kids? Is it for sort of stoner 20-somethings? Is it for Rick Mayall fans? Is it...
Because I know that from... as I always bang on about, our very limited experience in this arena, we used to get quite pissed off when the producers would say to us, you need to know who your target audience is. Who's your target audience? Who's your demographic? And we go, oh, we're just going to write it. It's for everyone. This is a prime example of why you need a target audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because this one has no idea what it is.
It doesn't. And I think when you're talking about subject matter, like an imaginary friend, you know, come to life or returned with all the dysfunctions and issues and problems of a 30-year-old woman, probably safer to aim it at the 30-year-old audience,
yes,
and kind of have like some real clever fun with it
because they can relate to a lot more than you as a 10-year-old.
Because it's quite a cool concept in a way.
It's a great concept.
Apparently, Tim Burton and Robin Williams were the first choices.
That could have worked.
That could have been great. You can really see Tim Burton with a much bigger budget than
It's de Jong. Yeah, and the visuals, particularly the sort of semi-dream sequence at the end. Under Tim Burton, that would have been much better than what we got, which was like a cheap 1980s pop video.
Yeah. Adult Lizzie loses her husband, she loses her job, and she loses her car in sort of the space of one lunch hour, doesn't she?
She does, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't really care. No.
Already you've checked out.
Yeah. You know she's being fired because she's walking out of a building carrying a cardboard box. Which is what everyone who gets fired does.
Nothing in it. It's just here's your cardboard box that you get when we fire you.
That's right, yeah. In Britain, they used to say collect your cards, but it's just collect your cardboard box. Yes. But on the way out with her cardboard box, she meets Mickey the Stalker.
Yeah.
Ron Eldard.
Wow, he's terrible in this.
Oh, fucking hell. Little Mickey from down the road. Mickey Bunce, or whatever his name was, from down the road. Man, he's terrifying. He's awful. I just can't stand him.
Because he's not bad in other things, Ron Eldard. He's not terrible in other films. He's in Sleepers with Brad Pitt and...
He is. He's in Black Hawk Down.
Black Hawk Down.
He's in that Ghost Ship one with his wife. Yeah. Is he still married to Juliana Margulies?
I don't know.
He was alright in ER.
Yeah, yeah. But just totally kind of miscast. He's got this kind of gee whiz thing about him. Yeah, the delivery of the lines. It's just miscast.
They basically said, smile and look optimistic.
Yeah.
And it's so creepy.
It's really creepy.
But he reminds her that, oh yeah, you were a difficult child. The audience hadn't kept up. Remember you had Fred, who you could see and nobody else could. Mm. And he used to get you into lots of trouble.
Thanks for explaining to us what an imaginary friend is.
And then I've just written, bloody hell, it's Carrie Fisher.
Yeah, she's playing that kind of, almost the same character she plays in When Harry Met Sally. That sort of more worldlier, professional friend, you know, who's kind of a bit more... Yep. A bit more savvy.
But again, there is no way I could work out why she would know or like Lizzie.
Yeah.
In completely different universes. It was when she was with Sally, when she was with Meg Ryan, completely understandable.
Yeah.
But this makes no sense. Apparently Carrie Fisher read for Lizzie. She wanted to play Elizabeth.
That would have been much better. You know, she would have imbued Lizzie with a bit of spunk.
She's also someone who's lived stuff like this.
Yeah.
She's gone through a lot of shit to get to this stage.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe Debbie Reynolds could have played the mother.
Now that is a film.
Stunt casting.
Yeah. That would have been superb.
But then, you know, it just became Postcards from the Edge with Meryl Streep. You're right, Lizzie is just... I know she's downtrodden and victimised and subjugated, but... just such a bland kind of sort of
so
insipid
beige.
Yeah. Phoebe Cates does her best.
Does she?
Well, I think once Fred comes into it, I actually think they play off each other quite well. That might be me trying to be very charitable.
Being generous,
I do like Phoebe Cates. But, you know, she does quite a good straight person to... I don't know.
No.
I don't
I don't know either, but... After being fired, she's obviously not living in the apartment with Charles anymore. She goes back home to Mother. Mother played by Marsha Mason.
Was she in a couple of Neil Simon adaptations?
Yeah, I can't think of any off the top of my head, more than likely. But I only recognise her as being Marty's girlfriend in about the second season of Frasier.
Oh, okay.
She was very, very brash. So very different to her to play such a different sort of starched character in this.
Mm.
But of course, Lizzie's home and she's treating her in exactly that same way, telling her about her manners. What do you say? Thank you, Mother, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, she very conveniently says, I've just cleaned the carpet, so whatever you do, don't go in there.
It's almost like a setup from a Tom and Jerry cartoon or something.
It is. It's absolutely Tom and Jerry. You're right. That's a perfect analogy.
Whatever you do, don't walk on this carpet.
You cat, don't go in there. And Jerry hears that, of course. Yeah. That is amazing.
So Lizzie's in her old room, just feeling shit about life.
Terrible.
And she sees her old, sort of an old jack-in-the-box that's taped up. She releases...
So it's a little hairy ball that bounces around the room.
Little hairy ball that bounces around the room and sort of rolls under the bed, and it's got this little tuft, like a troll doll.
Yes, yeah.
Old ginger tuft.
And about bloody time, Fred's here.
Yeah. How long does it take to that?
I didn't time it. It felt like about 9 hours.
Yeah.
I'd say it's probably about half an hour before Fred turns up.
And everything that Rick Mayall is absent from feels to me like a 90s sitcom.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's shot like a 90s sitcom. It's acted like a 90s sitcom. It feels like a 90s sitcom.
It's about as funny as a 90s sitcom.
Yeah. This whole film is almost like, could be like a failed pilot for a 90s sitcom about a woman and her imaginary friend, Mork and Mindy style.
It would actually work as a sitcom.
Yeah.
Well, it would exist. But then Fred starts getting up to his antics, He's pulling the heads off dolls and but then there was a bit that did make me laugh, is where he's sliding down the banisters and he smashes his bollocks on the end of the banister, which is that brilliant noise, that crunching
sound of
noise,
it, crunch,
which you only hear that noise when Rick Mayall bangs his bollocks on something. It's brilliant.
Do you know what sort of his experience was like making this? Have you read anything or have you heard anything? Or
I think it was quite good. He really, really wanted to do an American film.
Yeah.
And I think, believe it or not, he did contribute a lot to it.
Yeah.
Which would have been the anarchy.
Of course, yeah.
It would have been the snot, the poo, the cornflake explosions. I think he had a very jolly time.
Yeah.
But when Drop Dead 2 was mooted, he didn't want anything to do with it. And they offered it to Jim Carrey.
Ah, okay.
And, of course, about 2 years later, he played an anarchic, crazy man with cartoonish special effects in a green suit.
Yeah.
I don't think The Mask is a hasty rewrite of Drop Dead Fred 2, but it's a fascinating parallel.
Jim Carrey, if this was firmly pitched as a kid's film, would have probably walked that line better.
Yeah.
Because there are moments in this where you can see Rick Mayall in a flight of fancy. But he's, you know, comes out, he calls Lizzie's mum mega bitch and the bitch. And he's just a bit too edgy and a bit too...
Yeah.
You know, so if this was kind of an M-rated film, you can just see that he would have kind of let go and kind of get into it better, and it would have like been a better fit for his style.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
So he's crunched his balls.
And then, of course, the carpet comes into play.
Oh, yes.
And he does some very good dog shit comedy, which he's very good at. If you've ever seen the bit in More Bad News where he stands in dog shit.
I haven't.
It's really, really brilliant. He's walking down the street. He's in a suit. He slips in dog shit, takes his shoe off. Then he stands in it in his sock. And he's hopping around everywhere. It's brilliant. Look it up. It's really brilliant. So he's the master of dog shit comedy, as far as I'm concerned.
I just want to know what the dog's been eating, because it's the most liquefied dog poo I've seen in a while. It's dog diarrhea that he trips us through.
And a lot of it.
Yeah, a lot.
How big is that dog?
How big and how ill? I've
been giving Digby gravy or something, haven't they?
The other side to this is, so as an imaginary friend, all he did was totally fuck shit up.
Imaginary friends don't do that.
They don't really, really do that. I wouldn't have thought.
No.
But your imaginary friend just kind of keeps you company on your adventures and...
I'm guessing that the whole purpose of him as the imaginary friend is to rebel against Mother, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So under different circumstances... Maybe he would have been a nicer imaginary friend.
Yeah.
But
the
whole suggestion is that she conjured up Fred because she was in a childhood crisis.
And it becomes kind of like a chicken egg thing as well, because the more kind of outrageous the antics, the more controlling the mum gets. And there are some pretty outrageous antics.
Oh, they're bloody awful.
Yeah, they're horrible. They're not clever or funny.
It's not endearing in any way. Oh, cute, she's set fire to the house or got her father arrested. How amusing.
Well, she's tried to make some food and sort of mucked it up and made a mess, so that's cute. But
yeah, it's not like the Arctic roll in the beans or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's nothing like that,
yeah.
Is it? This is just deranged vandalism.
Mm.
But the other thing that I thought as well is, and as I'm sure you noticed, that her dad has got an English accent.
Yeah.
So first of all, I thought, oh, maybe she conjured up Fred to substitute an absent father. But he's there while this is going on. And he's nice.
I thought that was a some sort of, why would Fred be an Englishman or something?
Mm.
Oh, I know, she's got an English father who's the only other male figure in her life, so she creates, I don't know, it was just, that was the only thing I could think of. Why did they cast a...
But he's also the only positive role, so what? It's not like a substitution or anything. It's not like, I know, I haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, but...
Well, maybe he's, the father is kind of oppressed by the mum, so Fred is kind of like the... rebellious, defiant version of the father. I don't know. I think we're ascribing way too much into what is essentially a bad film. But
because I've overthought it, obviously, and then there are things that happen later on, which means that all of that conjuring it up to replace somebody or to add somebody doesn't work.
No.
When it's established that he's actually real, spoilers, none of that works.
Yeah.
Unless she can magically create people, real people, with her mind, like the Dark Half.
Phoebe Cates' Dark Place.
So then there's more antics. There's snot in the coffee. He traps his head in the fridge.
Yeah.
He gets her to say piss off, which was quite funny.
Yeah.
She says that the only thing that's going to make me happy is if I get Charles back.
And it's just sad. The whole character is just desperate and sad.
Someone who's literally been sort of abused and mistreated for her entire life.
I mean, even just the way that we've been overanalyzing this, you know, it does show that the concept is a rich. It could have been something.
But the fact that you and I, who are laymen, to say the least, when it comes to things like this, for us to pick so many holes and find faults with it in, 35 minutes, it obviously shows that the film is fundamentally flawed.
It made money, didn't it? I mean, it was only
very little, but it made money,
It was like a $6 million budget and made sort of $15 million or something.
I think it did very well in the video market.
It's over an hour and a half long. This is one of those films that you kind of think this actually should be 80 minutes.
Yeah. There are a couple of nice, almost touching scenes where Rick Mayall's allowed to do a bit more than just leap around and talk about snot, where he's actually being quite...
tender.
Quite tender.
Yeah.
And one that comes up where it's a flashback where she's a little kid and they play burglars.
Yeah, yeah.
And when all this is going on, they're sat up in a tree and he's basically saying to her, "You're great, you're really nice."
Yeah.
Why, don't be like her, you're really nice.
And he gives her a little cuddle and...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really sweet. He lets the kind of persona down of just being this total anarchic twat kind of down for a second and is allowed to be sort of human. And that is nice. Yeah, because there's not quite enough of that, is there, of why do they genuinely love each other?
Yeah, because if he's getting her into that much trouble, eventually she'd realise that he's just as bad as everybody else.
He's using me too. He's kind of, you know, yeah.
But I suppose then we get a few more antics.
We sink a ship.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the other bit that really pissed me off, is she sneaks on to sneaks out of the house and goes to Carrie Fisher's houseboat, asks if she can stay there because she doesn't want to go home, and she sinks it. There's no other way around it. She sinks the Carrie Fisher's house, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't really expand on that.
No, it would take quite an understanding friend to get over that one.
I wish she'd just piss off, to be honest. I'm sure Carrie Fisher feels the same.
Yeah.
So she goes to Carrie Fisher's place of work to say, "I'm sorry, I've...
sunk your house.
Rendered you homeless. I've sunk your house."
Yeah.
Fred's in the board meeting. So she's saying, "Yeah, Fred's in this chair." And so Carrie Fisher, to try and sort of placate and sort of play along with it, is having an argument with an empty chair.
Kind of like Clint Eastwood that time.
Yeah, very... Maybe that's where he got the idea from, yeah.
Now that would have been a movie.
Drop dead Clint.
He's a right Clint.
He is a total Clint, yeah. So she's having an argument with this empty chair and she's punching on it. And Lizzie knows he's not in there.
Yeah.
But at no point does she open her mouth and go, "No, he's not there." She just watches it and allows this to happen. It's horrible.
She's the true villain of the piece.
She is. She really is.
Well, she's broken, isn't she? She's a broken, broken woman.
So she goes out for lunch then with Mickey the Stalker.
Mm.
And does these hilarious involuntary actions, like waving her arms around. So Fred's waving her arms around and things.
Basically like, "Whose line is it anyway?" or something like that.
Yeah, your party quirk is that you wave your arm around with nobody noticing. But then she starts throwing plates around, and so Mickey the Stalker starts doing it as well. He thinks that if he acts as cuntishly as she does, that she's going to fall in love with him magically. So he's throwing plates around and throwing food, and then as he's getting thrown out of the restaurant, he goes, "What's the matter? It was just a joke."
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, is this the Bullingdon Club? Is he just going to throw a £50 note at a homeless person or something?
He throws a handful of, like, spaghetti at someone's face. Like, it's
he would have gone out of there in an ambulance.
Yeah, because he says in, like, a real high-pitched voice, isn't it? "I love how, like, unrestrained you are!" And it's just really...
It's horrible.
No, Ron Eldad.
No, don't love it. Run, yeah. Ron. Run, Ron. But if that's not enough... Then she goes to the mall, and there's a lovely little string quartet being played.
Yeah.
And she notices that Fred is playing a violin. So he's kind of replaced somebody playing a violin. Mm. And she's obviously had enough of Fred at this point. But rather than walk away, she attacks the violinist.
Mm.
She just starts smashing the violinist to pieces. And nobody intervenes. Everyone's just watching.
She's a menace.
She's a menace to society.
And these episodes just seem to continue at infinitum in the film, a flashback.
Yeah.
The little actor playing young Lizzie's quite cute.
She's alright.
Quite charming, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just a little flashback to apparently kind of illuminate why she's like this. And then just a really tiresome antics happening in the present day. And
you know, the screenwriter's obviously gone, "Oh, I've thought of another one. Let's put it there. Oh, I can think of another one. Let's just chuck it in there." And it lends nothing to the overall story. There's so much of this.
It's just episodic.
But then, of course, her mum does what anyone would do, and takes her to see a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But it's the old child psychologist that she had from the olden days. It's quite cool, this bit that happens in the waiting room.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the kind of one scene, again, that had heaps of potential.
Yeah.
It could have been like, you know, if this was bigger budget, better actors, or, you know, because this would be an opportunity to have kind of like some stunt casting with some kind of like big names just in a little cameo. Yeah. And like,
you could have got the SNL crew in or something like that. Or,
yeah.
Or the comic strip. You know, it would have been a funny little nod.
You should have had Aid Edmondson in here.
Edmondson, get Nigel Planer and Peter Richardson in. It would have been great. Or get Dawn French in or something.
Yeah.
It would have been amazing. But no.
No, and so this is where Fred meets the other imaginary friends of the kids that have kind of been taken to this child psychiatrist, presumably to be medicated.
Now, this is the bit, while it's quite a cool scene, it does blow the illusion out that he's a figment of her imagination. Yeah. It finally says, yes, they're real.
Yeah.
And while it was a cool scene, it's a bit of a letdown.
But it's, yes, they're real, but they can only see their own imaginary friend, can't they?
Yeah, but they are all there.
They are all there, yeah. They will see each other.
There is a scene right at the end that confirms that he is actually real as well.
Yeah.
And I just figured that I preferred it when she was mad, rather than he is actually real and she's not mad.
It's almost a cop-out, isn't it? Because there's no real internal logic to it, and to the sort of the world-building thing. It's not kind of like, you know, Monsters, Inc., where there's this kind of rock-solid, they live in another dimension and they can come through
under
your bed and da-da-da. And so, you know, you can see why they're kind of imaginary. They seem imaginary to a kid in the real world, but they actually do exist in their own reality.
It did remind me of something. I think it was on The Fear, where Joel Morris is talking about why he doesn't like The Shining. Is because he thought it was brilliant when he thought it was a man going mad, but when the freezer door opens and you realise that there are actually ghosts in it, he just felt really let down.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a crap analogy for Drop Dead Fred, comparing it to The Shining. But I had the same sort of feeling. I thought it was much more interesting if it did sort of dabble in the fact that he's been created by her psyche.
Yeah,
because of all the abuse that she's had, rather than the fact that, oh, he's actually real. They're all real. They all exist.
Or if they just left it kind of ambiguous till the end, and you weren't quite sure.
Because then, of course, she's given these green pills, where if she takes them, Fred will disappear. So that doesn't make sense if he's real.
Well, unless he's just a real manifestation of something that's within you, you know, like your real manifestation of your id, or...
No matter how outlandish a plot should be, there needs to be some internal logic.
There needs to be internal logic,
This doesn't have any.
Yeah, it's like a time travel movie that sort of fudges the rules.
And if we're given this much to think about when we're watching something so effectively childish, then there's something wrong with the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just trying to think of other things while I was watching this. like Rip Mayall being the imaginary friend in other movies. Imagine him serving Jack Nicholson drinks in The Shining.
You've always been here, Mr. Torrance. He would improve every film, I think, except this one, which is ironic because this is the only one he's been in. But yeah, so she gets the green pills, which she's been told will get rid of Fred. But just to make sure, her mum hires a wrestler to look after Lizzie, who will basically say, oh, I'll break your legs if you try and escape, and things like that, which is nice.
Yeah.
If you didn't think things were bad enough, Mickey turns up climbing a tree, trying to break into her room.
Good old Mickey.
He's such a bellend.
He's a creep.
Yeah, he's awful.
As is... literally everyone in this movie.
Everybody is horrible in this. With the possible exception of Carrie Fisher, the only annoyance with her is her tolerance is way too high. She'd have given up on her ages ago.
And she's almost in a different movie to the others.
I did read she was allowed to make up her own lines.
Okay.
I could tell. Yeah. She's a writer.
And she's probably got the best lines in the film.
Yeah.
So Lizzie goes back to Charlie. They go to Charlie's party.
Because I think we get another flashback where we see Fred being taped up. There's the cornflakes disease bit with his cornflakes exploding out of Fred.
Yeah.
And so she tapes up the Jack in the Box.
Puts the genie in the bottle.
Because, of course, we're meant to think that, you know, the whole purpose of this is Lizzie's mum is so awful to Lizzie.
Mm.
That we're meant to feel sorry for Lizzie and her mum's evil. It's the other way around. Lizzie has driven her to this.
Yeah.
I think Lizzie has been so awful and naughty that her mum's just trying to be strict to put a cap on it.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, I'm a parent, and I've told you about my experiences of today. I kind of feel for Lizzie's mum.
She's just trying to... She doesn't know what to do with this unruly child.
Dad's buggered off.
Mm.
I feel quite sorry for her, really. But yeah, you're right. She goes to Charles's party in an attempt to win Charles back. So she goes dressed up. And then there's a really horrible bit where Fred looks up Bridget Fonda's skirt.
Yeah.
And he says, no panties. Which sounds even more lurid when a British person says it.
And I actually remember the trailer for Drop Dead Fred featured that, the TV trailer. I remember that as a kid because me and my friends used to sort of laugh at that bit. And we should, of course, say this is the second time he's done an upskirt. He did it to the mother and said, ooh, cobwebs.
That's right.
Problematic.
Incredibly so. Before I watched this, I thought, well, if it's even decidedly average,
yeah,
I might let my daughter watch it because she likes a bit of fun, a bit of anarchy. Mm. No way on earth, not just because it's shit, there's no way on earth I'd let her watch this, because he's looking at a woman's vagina for quite a long time. So it's really horrible, but Charles suddenly finds Lizzie attractive again because she's wearing some different clothes.
It's like the old teen movie kind of take off your glasses and undo your ponytail, you're gorgeous, sorry. Yeah.
And as he's seducing her, he says, don't talk, just kiss, which is, of course, by Right Said Fred.
Yeah, the prequel to this movie. Now, imagine if Rick Mayall was in Right Said Fred.
Well, I'd rather see a Right Said Fred biopic than have to watch this again. Yeah. Then we get a bit of bottom in the nicest possible way, the TV show, because the nurse gets smacked in the face with a frying pan. She goes back to the apartment. Does Charles say the wrong name during
his course? They're sort of he's telling her that he loves her, and he calls her, he says they're kissing, and he says, oh, Annabella.
Instead of,
and then he tries to say, well, surely it's better that I said Annabella, but I'm with you.
Than the other way around. Jesus Christ.
By this point, I'm really, I'm a little bit cross with you, Chris, that you put me through this.
I've got my head in my hands here.
In our back catalogue, there have been some films that have been a real struggle. This has got to be in that kind of top three for me. It's just a real struggle. It's not so bad, it's good. It's the same beats over and over again.
Before I started watching it, I did a bit of looking around, and I see it's got a 9% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. And I thought, that's a bit harsh. Maybe they just don't get the British humour. But
yeah.
Well, that's about right.
If this was a British film with British sensibility crafted around this, I think it would do better.
At some point, they did consider, I can't remember who it was, but they did want an English actress to play Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
But Rick Mayall put his foot down. He said, well, what's the point in doing an American film
if
the main two in it are English? We may as well just go and shoot it in London.
Yeah.
So, should have used Carrie Fisher. But Lizzie, of course, finally comes to her senses when she's taken a few green pills and Fred's dying. But she hears Charles on the phone talking to Annabella, saying, don't worry about her, I love you.
I've got her under control.
Yeah.
Basically, I can gaslight her until it's all very horrible.
Yep. So she passes out, she faints, and sort of goes to dreamland, effectively.
Which looks like a really bad 90s music video set. Or it's really low budget.
He helps her to see the error of her ways, and she exercises her demons and literally frees her inner child. The child comes out of her.
Luckily, Cronenberg wasn't filming this. It would have been a grim moment.
Yeah, she would have given birth to the inner child, wouldn't she? It would have been horrible. But then, of course, Fred effectively says, there's no need for me anymore. It's like the Mary Poppins or Nanny McPhee.
Yeah, yeah.
When you don't want me, I'm here. When you don't need me, I'll be gone. And so he basically says, all you need to do is say my name, give me a kiss, and I'm gone.
Yeah.
And he's brilliant in this scene.
He is.
The sentimentality is so lovely. I wish there was more of it. But yeah, she does. She does the ritual, and he's gone. He's gone for good. And so she wakes up, and now she's new Lizzie. Big, strong Lizzie. And she demonstrates that by just emptying an undressed salad on his head. Yeah. It would have taken him seconds just to pick out the lettuce. There's no dressing on it or anything.
Just brush it off,
yeah. I mean, the suit would have been fine. It's got flecks on it already. But then she picks her nose and puts snot on his face, which was a nice touch.
Yeah.
I quite like that.
She should have stuck a bit of mesclun onto the snot. A little leaf of rocket. There you go.
Maybe a bit of chili down the trousers would have done the job. So that's it. She's free. Charles is gone. So she goes home to move out. So she tells her mum that's it, I'm done. And she tells her mum maybe you should get a friend. I think that's bloody harsh. She's spent her life raising this really problematic child. Mm. And then she goes, oh, Billy No Mates, basically.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
It is a bit. She's an unfairly vilified character in this film, the mum.
I think so. The mum's the real victim in this.
Not a mega beast and a bitch.
But it doesn't end that well for Lizzie. because, of course, she ends up with Mickey the Stalker.
Like, and what universe are we supposed to think that he's a catch and just, like, charming?
Well, the 2 minutes after the credits roll, she's not going to end up being buried under the patio.
Yeah.
That's what happened to his first wife. She left me. Yeah, Mickey, yeah, yeah. But then Mickey's daughter, it turns out, has drop-dead Fred as an imaginary friend. So again, this raises so many questions. It again suggests that Fred is actually real, because exactly the same character has been conjured up by somebody else. But, at the same time, Fred was meant to have been conjured up because Lizzie had this abusive, possessive childhood. Is that the same of Mickey's daughter?
It's alluded to that he's English because his father's English.
Yeah, that too.
So there's a finite number of imaginary friends that get passed around or they transfer to other kids. It's like a possession.
Yeah. It's like the ring.
Yeah.
But we're led to believe that Lizzie had Fred and he was really awful because her mum was terrible and she was rebelling and her dad was English. Fred is exactly the same with this other girl. So is Mickey like that? Is he an awful father? He probably is because he's terrible. But...
Yeah, well, he's psychotic. But by all accounts, it seems like
a
dad.
Lovely man, yeah.
Yeah, so there's no internal logic, no consistent logic to what's going on. They just thought it was kind of a cute little button to put on the film. Yeah. You know, it's all right, viewers. He's not dead. He's still living on through
this.
Don't
worry, kids. Yeah. But under better hands, they could have played that ending like a twist in a horror movie.
Yeah.
Rather than playing it for laughs, it would have been, at the end. And that would have been even better.
Yeah.
Well, not even better. It would have been good.
Perhaps this well-adjusted girl is going to now go through all the same problems that Lizzie had.
Exactly.
Dark.
And I've just written one word at the end of this, and it is crap.
It's we don't even need to ask the question, do we? I'll ask it just because I won't be able to sleep at night if we've finished an episode and no one's asked it.
People will write in. I wish they would. Do write in.
So Chris, is Drop Dead Fred still any good?
Drop Dead Fred is fucking awful.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
It was never good, Chris.
No. Some people still favourably, you read on social media, Drop Dead Fred. When I said, the usual thing where I put research and did a little gif of the film, there were a lot of likes, and I got like messages from other people saying, great, it's going to be brilliant, can't wait to hear that one. Sorry, it's awful. I know this is the life we chose.
Yeah,
this is the whole point of what we do.
It is.
But
it is.
I can't imagine why I would have enjoyed this first time round, other than my blinkered love for Rick Mayall. But that only takes me so far.
Is it Mayall-tinted glasses that people watch this through?
Obviously, most of what he did that was amazing was on telly. So it does make me think that as brilliant as he was, his particular brand of comedy maybe wasn't enough to carry a film. I'm not blaming him for the content of the film.
Yep.
He just wanted to do an American film, and that's great. That's fine.
Mm.
But this one, dearie me.
Yeah, I mean, too dark for kids and just too puerile and juvenile for adults. No real arc. Lizzie ostensibly goes through an arc from, you know, simpering victim to kind of independent, strong.
She has some growth, absolutely.
It's done in a really ham-fisted way. And it's
But it's
not...
also at the expense of everybody else.
Yeah,
somebody loses their house. Somebody who's raised her for 30 years is basically told just fuck off and get a life.
Someone loses their violin.
Yeah. Another child gets possessed by this demon. A child who apparently was very nice to begin with.
Really, this film should be called Drop Dead Pazuzu. it's a comedy reimagining of The Exorcist.
It's a comedy exorcist. But it really is a game of two halves. One member of the cast is doing a completely different film from everybody else.
Yeah.
Rick Mayall is fine in this. He does the crazy, puerile kid stuff, which would fit brilliantly in a kid's film. Everybody else is trying to make some sort of psychological adult comedy. Of course it's not going to work. And I'm quite angry.
Yeah, it's a concept I think that could have worked. Oh, well, it didn't.
Do I need to ask, did you like it?
Oh, God, no. No, it was awful. Really, it peaked in the pre-credits.
I'm so sorry.
It really peaked in that pre-credit sequence. And worse than being awful for me, it was just really boring. Terrible use of a Rick Mayall. I went in, I like Phoebe Cates, I think she's great. And I wanted her to be good in this. And she, you know, the character just was awful and she kind of phoned it in. And is it any coincidence that 4 years later she retired from acting forever?
There was no way up from there, was there?
Is there causation? So... God, when she got home to Kevin Kline, you know, after the screening of this.
So disappointed.
He just would have. God.
He'd have still been in there dusting his Oscar, wouldn't he? And he said, "You did this. You should have done Lace 3 instead."
She should have.
Which one of you pricks is my baby? Or something. Yeah. Oh, you know. In our pantheon of films, some have been very good, some have been not so good, and some have been downright awful. Where do you think this sits, honestly?
How many have we done? About 25, something like that?
This is our 33rd recording.
Wow,
33rd. I know.
I would put this in the bottom, no pun intended, bottom, four or five?
It's down there with some of my other choices, isn't it? Like Digby and Smokey and the Bandit.
I actually enjoyed Smokey and the Bandit quite a bit more than this.
I think I might have. This could actually be the worst one.
This could be.
Yeah.
The Big Bus was hard.
Big Bus was disappointing.
I have found it hard to get through, but it had a better build-up. And just for the sheer impressiveness of the bus itself.
Yeah.
This is way down there.
Because what I've done, just for a bit of fun, I know not everything has to be a competition.
No.
But I thought it would be quite fun to run through, which I have done,
yep.
everything that we've looked at. Looked at what you've chosen, looked at what I've chosen, and see how many of those are still any good. And so sort of who's winning, if you like. Who's chosen the best good films.
Oh, this is exciting. Yeah.
Ones where you thought they were good and I didn't, or vice versa, I've excluded.
Yep. Oh, good.
And ones that we thought were crap, I've excluded. So out of the now 33 films, or Tales of the Unexpected, that we've chosen, believe it or not, a whole 7 of mine have been good. I'm not going to name them because I'll probably struggle. I included Krull in that.
You have
chosen 10 good films.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was hoping for more than that, but okay. We haven't really disagreed that often, though, have we? There's not been a lot of disagreement.
No, we disagreed, I think, on Body Double.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant film.
I wasn't... not my cup of tea, to be fair. But more often than not, we have agreed more or less. I think you disliked Home Alone more than I did. But more often than not, we've been on the same page, so...
Mm.
You're 10-7 up at the moment, and tonight's has changed nothing. So I'm wondering if next time's might have an influence on it.
So it's my choice, and now that I know the score, if you will...
You've chosen Raiders of the Lost Ark!
Yeah, that's a little-known film from my childhood called Schindler's List.
Godfather.
I'm a bit worried now, because I've picked a film that I haven't seen probably for, 30 years.
Ooh.
Maybe 29, 28 years. But it was one that I watched, probably inappropriately for my age, quite a few times.
It's not another sex film, is it?
I don't know. I can't even remember. I know that there's sex in it.
I take the bus.
But it was one that, again, as with many of these films and many films that I watched as a child, it was one that my brother, 7 years older than me, I don't know if it was on video or whatever, but, you know, he'd be watching it and laughing, and I'd be like thinking, well, this is cool because, you know, my older brother likes it and this is kind of funny. It's a film, I think it's, 1981, 1982? The debut of John Cusack, to give you an idea of its vintage.
Ooh.
And it's not really one that gets talked about very much these days. It is the 80s film starring Rob Lowe and Andrew McCarthy and Jacqueline Bisset.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm with you now.
Saucy Jackie Saucy. Bisset. It is class.
Now, I have seen this.
Mm.
Just the once, probably around about the same time. I'd say probably 30, maybe 32 years ago, something like that.
Yeah, and I really only remember kind of what happens at the beginning, what happens in the middle, and what happens at the end, and a couple of...
But that's the whole film.
But just like the start of it, vaguely what happens in the middle, and kind of the very last, I think, kind of scene.
I remember very, very little other than who's in it and what effectively happens, the thing that happens in it.
So those stalwarts of the 80s, Rob Lowe and Andrew McCarthy and...
Until you said Jacqueline Bisset, I thought you were going to say St. Elmo's Fire.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I never liked St. Elmo's Fire.
No, I think it's terrible.
It was awful. Whereas I've got fond memories of this, just because it's me and my brother on the couch having a giggle.
At sexy things. Excellent. Well, that's one of the reasons we choose these films. It's not... It's how you remember them as well. And it's just you and your brother having a laugh. That's like me with my score of Butlin's films, you know, I just remember because of what we were doing at the time. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Good choice.
So, yeah, I haven't really looked into, you know, the Rotten Tomatoes rating or kind of how this is viewed critically.
I've learned it's best not to until you've watched it.
Yeah.
So this, you could formulate your own opinion.
This could really, this could be a black mark. Who knows? We'll see. We'll find out if it's still any good.
I look forward to it.
Mm. So, usual housekeeping?
Yeah, let's do that. So, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood. And if you ever fancy emailing us, it is StillAnyGood@gmail.com. If you do like us, could you rate us on iTunes? Could you like and rate us? Because
yeah, we've run out of relatives to do it for
us. Somehow it makes us easier to find or something.
Yeah. All right, Chris. Well, I'll see you soon.
Certainly will. You have a good night.
You too.
Yep, and we'll see you all soon, folks.
See you.
See you. Bye.
What exactly was your winning slogan?
Never, ever, bloody anything, ever.
And that was your winning slogan?
That's the one, Nicky. I've lived my life by that rule.
I would like to spend an evening with Nicholas Parsons because never, ever, ever, bloody anything, ever.
You're pissed, aren't you, Nicholas?